So you were talking about teaching,
making
up teaching materials. And
teaching
making up
materials,
problems.
Yeah. And so anyway, I would have a little test to check their readiness or check and see if they knew terminology. And it would be just kind of a fun test. I would make, you know, of like 10 questions and to see if we were all on the same page. Because a lot of times there would be somebody in the group that was a business, which would be a whole different type of seminar. And so you had to make sure that, you know, the group was a cohesive group and that you knew who needed a little more help and who didn't, and so that when you, and also I would have exercises for them to do after I would demonstrate a database. Another thing I would do is I would, one of my favorite activities when there was time, especially if the longer seminars, was to tell them that they were now philanthropists and they had $100,000, and who are they going to give it to? And that would be very revealing, because they had to say who they were going to give the amount to and why. And there would be people that would say, well, I would like to give my money to such and such an organization. And I'd say, well, where is that organization? And they'd say, well, it's in Philadelphia. And I'd say, well, why Philadelphia? And they'd say, well, I went to school there and I really, you know, I want to give it to, you know. And somebody else would say, well, I'm very interested in, you know, and they would say some animal rights group or something. And so then that would show everyone else in the group that when you search for a database, it's not just a subject area that you look up, if at all, that you have to think in terms of the philanthropist or the foundation that's giving the money, and like who the person is that started, person or persons were that started that nonprofit. And so the more you look for information about them and what they're, and try to find their interests, then you can match yours, what you want, with what they want to give. And then you can tell them that this is what these databases do, is they let you search geographically by recipient. Like, for instance, if you're in a certain geographic area, might be eligible, but you might be excluded. So you also are teaching people, too, when they use these databases, how to not out things, too. Like some foundations only will give, say, to organizations overseas. So, you know, you learn how to use these databases in a more sophisticated manner.
So maybe one more thing about grants might lead to some more stuff, but you know, in your resume you had the longer resume, you had sort of a nice yearly snapshot of, you
mm-hmm.
know, who you talk to, and
yeah.
So, and that's great, but I'm wondering if there are sort of unique requests or unique teaching moments, you know, over the course of, it sounds like it was close to 20 years, maybe like 15, 20
yeah.
years.
Well, one thing that I thought might be fun to mention that is that I did some statistics, and from April until I retired, which was, I guess I said 2006, mm-hmm. end of 2006, I just with reference questions, I answered 2,300 that were grant related, and that's not reference questions. It's grant related reference questions, in addition to regular reference questions. And I answered 3,635 research queries by email between 2001 and 2006. So there's an awful lot of email, and especially by conventional mail that still rolled in, and I had a foot high fold. I had folders that measured a foot high of correspondence that I saved of questions that letters that I and their and how I answered them. So I did quite a lot of work there.
So the 2,300 was from what time period? 2,300.
That was only since April 2004 until
2006.
So I mean, that was we started. I know that you can't that. I'm holding up a visual aid, but
right.
This is kind of, that I haven't. We started taking statistics and recording questions at the reference department for a variety of reasons, and everybody didn't participate, but I did because I was kind of curious to find out how many. You could search by words, and so I put in the word grant, scholarships, things like that. And I also thought it would be fun to, in later years, to just look at the kinds of questions I had. And all of those that I have there are not grant-related, but a number of them are.
Sure.
And
so we're looking at a print-off of a database. Looks like...
for the reference department.
For PS.
At the desk.
And the database or the reference tool called PS Stats.
Yeah.
It's a multi-page document. We might...
It's just a window into
right.
a short period of time. And but anyway, one thing that I wanted to mention was that, and I said this in a speech during my retirement, was that one thing that was kind of interesting was that a man in Buenos Aires, Argentina, he was from there, and he told me that a friend of his in Dubai attended a grants for organization seminar when he was in Madison, and actually the guy was in Buenos Aires, and he emailed me that a friend of his in Dubai had attended a grant for organization seminar in Madison, and he was wondering if I could send him extra handouts from the class, send them to Buenos Aires. I thought that was kind of interesting. And there are quite a number of international students that came to the Grants Information Center, as it was called then. It wasn't called the Grant Information Collection. They would come because they wanted to go back, with some information about grants. And one man that I really, really enjoyed talking to was a Tanzanian student. And he was also an official in his country. And he said that he needed fishing nets in fishing communities in his country because there's a shortage of nets. And, stuff like that. And I got to know so much about other countries and their needs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of felt the collection in Madison was helping, in a real good way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that was kind of not something that really was too bad about being a grant collection librarian is that after when the person leaves, you don't know if the information was used. You don't know if they got a grant. I have letters and letters and letters of appreciation but very, very few about, oh, I got a grant, you know. Because it, by the time, you know, someone gets a grant, it's months later and, you know, they've written a proposal or they've, you know, done all these other things they had to do to get a grant. So you're the last thing they think about, you know, as part of the process. So the feedback, it wasn't all that great. It had to be feedback that was internal. You know.
Mm-hmm. So the letters of appreciation were more thank you for teaching the class or thank you for giving me the material.
Right.
Not so much I got the grant, so
yeah,
I save
all these thank you cards and letters
mm-hmm.
and everything. And I'm going to ask David Knoll if he wants them in UW archives, but I kept them because I didn't think anybody'd be interested in them, and maybe no one still will, but I'll offer them.
Okay.
But one of the thank you notes is from the, and I had forgotten that I had done this, but there are 24 librarians from U.S. embassies abroad that came to the UW for a seminar from the Department of State. And so I thought that was kind of neat that, you know, that they came here, gathered here to come
mm-hmm.
to the grant collection
mm-hmm.
to get a seminar on how they could help people in other countries find grants. And I have some other letters too.
So you were just basically, you were holding a fairly thick manila and file folder there.
Yeah.
And those are
thank you
the
notes.
Thank yous that you've gotten.
Yeah. I had at one time thought that it might be nice to make a file of all the different nonprofits that came and, you know, and then maybe have, you know, emails to them, you know, with updates, you know, of, you know, grant information. But then I thought, this is ridiculous. You know, I'm only one person. I can't do anything like this. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you'd have to be the foundation center itself. And so, but anyway, it was a way to be involved with something larger than myself.
The one question I was supposed to feed you about unique requests was one about a boat, but I'm wondering if that was actually the fishing nets.
No.
That's different. All right, then. Well, then.
No.
What does me saying the word boat mean to you, then?
Oh, I got an email from this boat, and I think it was in the Mediterranean, and this man said he needed a grant because he for additional equipment because he was about to discover a gigantic squid, and so anyway, he was wondering if somehow I could help him find a grant immediately. Well, I couldn't, you know, find him a grant, and I told him that, you know, the kind of grant he was looking for would, you know, probably take longer than, you know, a few weeks. And I wished I probably gave him, you know, some names and addresses of organizations. But he was a bona fide researcher, I'm sure he. And then it turned out recently, I think it was last year, there was a giant squid that was discovered for the first time.
Hmm.
I think it was off the Sea of Japan, but don't quote me on that.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the Sea of Japan.
Hmm. So
but anyway, we had a good laugh over that because, I mean, in our ignorance, you know, we thought, well, you know, looking for a giant squid was really, funny, and we just thought, you know, it was just crazy, but
right.
It obviously was not.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Is there anything else you want to say about your time working with grants?
I don't think so, but I do want to mention that one letter of thanks that I got that I've always appreciated, and this person had written to me, I think it was some African, one of the African nations, but I didn't record it. But he said he wanted grants for, and this is his list, housing / funding of orphan and abandoned children, comma, free medical services, comma, poverty alleviation, comma, rural development / skill acquisition, comma, calming down youth, unrestiveness, and secret cults. And so anyway, I wrote him back, unfortunately, we are not a grant-making organization. That was something a lot of people thought, that we gave grants.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore cannot provide you with funding assistance. However, you might be interested in looking at the online directory of development organizations. This directory includes African-focused organizations arranged by country. Many of these organizations provide grants, humanitarian aid, and services. And I gave him a website for this directory, which was a wonderful directory for African nonprofits. And so anyway, and then I gave him another site for international funding. Said very sincerely, Elizabeth Bree Grant Librarian. And then, well, anyway, I got a note back from him via email saying, "Dear Sister Elizabeth, you are God's sent. I am short of words for your information. The Lord, who is the rewarder of every good things, will meet you always, even when you don't call him. His precious blood will be an immunity for your life. You will see your great grant children. Even at your old age, you will bear forth good fruits. Your children will speak to your enemies at the gate. No good thing with God withhold from you. Sister, you are blessed, and may the hosts of heaven say a big amen and amen." So anyway, that was the most unusual thank you note I'd ever gotten.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
yeah, that's interesting, that's for sure.
It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm left with, unless you have other things you want to talk about, which I'll give you space for, is you alluded to a little bit about why, at least an anecdote about why you retired. Do you want to maybe talk more about why 2006 was the time to retire and move on?
A number of people I'd worked with had retired, and it seemed to me that there were a lot of new people, and there was so much specialization now in the department that it wasn't a cohesive unit that it used to be. And I really didn't feel that. I felt reference was so much instruction now. I felt like sitting all day, I was getting out of shape and gaining weight, and I just felt like I didn't want to spend any more years just in front of a computer all day, except when I was teaching. I just didn't want that anymore. And another thing too, again, you know, with so many of so much of technology, it was less of a social thing. I mean, you didn't have the person-to-person contact you had before. I felt I was learning more about database protocols than I was really learning about other kinds of things that would develop my knowledge and give me more experience about what libraries were about, or why I had become a librarian. And then one day I thought, gee, it might be fun to go back down to half time and maybe see what, if that would be a possibility. So I went up to the personnel department and I asked about retiring half time. Not retiring half time, but going down half time, and if it would affect my ultimate retirement pay. And I was told it was the three highest years of earnings. It wasn't necessarily the three latest years of earnings. And then the personnel librarian said, why don't you retire? Have you been interested in retiring? And I said, well, I had thought about it, but I wasn't quite sure. And so anyway, I left. So I said, I thought it might be a neat idea to consider. Well, the next thing I knew, it was announced to my supervisor that I had said that I was going to retire, and it just like went like wildfire over it, throughout the library, and it was really weird. So I said to Nancy, I said, well, actually, I just inquired about working half time. But I said, you know, maybe it is a good time to retire. So maybe instead of going through all the thing about, well, I really wasn't quite sure, and then having the personnel librarian embarrassed and all that sort of stuff, I decided I would retire. And so I gave a date. And then I was asked, I was told by the personnel librarian that oftentimes that there's a rehire, you can be rehired, you know, and, you know, after you formally retired, and maybe, you know, and that might be a possibility. And so anyway, I thought that would be good. But then when that actually happened and I was rehired, it was kind of a letdown because it wasn't the same, because, you know, everyone had like had this big retirement party and everything. I was supposed to be retired, and then I was rehired. And then the person that wanted the job was one of the, you know, potential applicants. She was frustrated. She had been working in the library for a few years, and she was looking forward to my retirement. And so, to make a long story short, I left in December. But it's kind of interesting because some of the people that retired when I did, I shouldn't say some, but one in particular I know is still there as a rehire. It's something that I think is no longer being done, and I think it's probably a very good idea.
Not to
rehire unless there's a really, really good reason. I think if you decide to retire, then that's a decision that you've decided to retire. I think new people should come in, and if you retire, that means you move on. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're rehired, it's because they can't find someone, you know, or somebody's sick and you can fill in. But it's kind of like with Brett Favre. People got really annoyed when he retired, and then he decided not to retire. I mean, there was no real reason to get annoyed at him. I mean, he just thought, well, retirement sucks, and so I'd like to play mm-hmm. again. And but people, I don't know, it's just the way things mm-hmm. appear.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm glad I retired. I've done an awful lot since I retired, so I wouldn't have traded those years for anything.
Any post-retirement activities you would like to get on the record? Things you've been doing in the last almost 7 years now?
Well, I joined Wisconsin Visual Artists, which is a group I really enjoy. And I've been able to enjoy my horse more, my Icelandic horse. One thing that happens when you retire too is you find your parents need help. So I've been able to go back and forth to and from upstate New York and spend time with my mother, who eventually is now in a nursing home. But and I've noticed that with other people that have retired, that they oftentimes have family responsibilities that they now have more time for. It's not something that you would hoped to do, but at least you're more available. And also I've been able to help out people too. I'm more available for you know, giving people rides to doctors and things like that. And I've been able to do things that I've never done before. I bought a house later than most people in 2001. And so I've been able to see what, you know, having a house is like, and I never did before. I never had time. I've been able to learn about plants and gardening, and that I can actually grow things. And I know that sounds like, you know, not very much, but to me it's just amazing. I've learned a lot more about the world around me and how to fix things, and it's been really nice to do that. I've done quite a bit of writing poetry, and I've taken quite a few art courses through UW Continuing Education, which is just wonderful. It's a wonderful program. And so I now have my own personal art studio above my garage, and I've been exhibiting in all sorts of places, like Old Brick Gardens and Pyle Center, UW Hospital and Clinic. I exhibited years ago in places such as that, but now it's paintings, and so that's been really fun, and I've gotten to know a lot of new people.
Okay, so a couple more things about your work life. What would you consider? Well, let's start with the negative before we go with the positive.
Okay.
Any regrets? Things that you wanted to get done that just didn't happen.
Well, I think that I kind of wish that I had worked in rare books more. I did the best I could, I think, with my location, and like I mentioned before, you know, I always had migraine headaches, and it was really a severe, and it still is a severe problem. So I think given the situation, that it was the best fit for me. But one thing about reference public service is that you don't have something solid in your hands or to look at that shows for all those years. And I knew years ago when I went into reference, I thought, well, like, I always was thinking ahead, and I always thought, well, at least with art, you know, you can show your paintings, and you can, you know, you're constantly, you know, building up a body of work. But in reference, you don't. It's kind of ephemeral, and you don't know how much you really helped, and then if it really matters. I mean, I go through all these mind games with myself. But I don't really regret very much. It would have been fun to see what I could have done in the art area. But again, I think my mother was right. I don't think that it would have been fun supporting myself. I remember going to an art lecture about careers when I was taking a few courses in drawing in the art department. And this woman was talking about how she had ended up designing handles for cars, you know, with her art degree. And I thought, thank God I'm a librarian. I thought I could just be in a print shop, you know, just, you know, Xeroxing things for people or designing greeting cards and with my calligraphy and earning, you know, very low pay, minimum wage. I'm glad I'm a librarian, because I have a salary, I've got retirement, I've got health insurance, and I just was so happy you know, that I wasn't building a new career.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So now let's look at the positive. What would you consider to be your accomplishments, your biggest accomplishments?
Well, one thing about being a reference librarian is that it makes you a more social person. I was a very quiet, withdrawn person. Not that withdrawn, but I was quite an introvert, so I think that that's really helped a lot. It made me more self-assured. As far as, you know, like visible accomplishments, to tell you the truth, I'm not quite sure, except that I know that there are 250 plus practicum students out there that I got on their feet, you know, to become reference librarians, or at least to do better in public service. Hopefully there are a substantial number of people that got grants with my help, or at least know how to find them. And librarians are, as a group, a great population group to work with. I'm so lucky that to be around intelligent people that have many, many different interests. And I really, really miss, you know, conversations about different areas of study, questions that where I have to use my mind and I have to think quickly. So I'm really glad that I was able to use my mind and that I was able to work with interesting people. I can't say that there is anybody that I ever worked with that was detestable. I can say that there are people that came and go that were characters like out of Dickens, you know. But I, you know, they were, it wasn't, you know, you didn't feel like you had to quit your job or, you know, anything like that. And also I was very, very lucky to work at such an incredible university, and I really, really miss the help desk. Is it still called the help desk?
It's a good question.
Well, you're over at Steenbach.
Yeah, I'm over
at
Steenbach. I don't think so, but I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. But, anyway, it was just wonderful because I remember once at the reference desk, one of the librarians that was with me on the reference desk, she tripped on a cord and the entire computer went down, smashed on the floor. We had two computers at the reference desk and it just smashed to pieces. So anyway, I was helping someone and I said to the person I was helping, I said, "Would you excuse me a minute?" So I called the help desk and I said, "We've just smashed a computer accidentally. We were wondering if you could come and give us a little bit of help and see if it can be fixed." Within 10 minutes, the help desk had come with a new computer and it hooked it up within 15. I was so impressed. It was a working computer. We could just continue on with the day. Yeah. I mean, how many places do you work? Can you work in where you don't have to like order a computer,
right,
go through acquisitions, you know, wait 6 weeks or 2 months or more? I mean, they were phenomenal.
I think I call that, I don't know if I call it LTG, Library
LTG.
Technology Group. So
yeah,
yes,
LTG.
They are very much still around. They are actually going to put 3 computers in the studio we have in Steenbach tomorrow.
Wonderful.
So, Liz, anything else you want to add before we shut off the recorder?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, this concludes the interview with Elizabeth Breed. Liz, thanks for your time.
You're very welcome.
Okay, today is December 13th, 2013. This is a redo of part of an interview that I did with Liz Breed yesterday. So
And my name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. So Liz, if you wouldn't mind, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Yes, it's Elizabeth Breed, capital B-R-E-E-D.
Thank you. So yesterday we started off, you had some dates and some names you wanted to clarify, so why don't we start there?
Sure. I just wanted to mention that that there are that it might be helpful to, as you said, to mention dates. And one is that I began in the at the library October, November 1972, and I officially retired August 06. I was one of those rehires, however, so I did work as a, it's called a rehire, until the end of December of 06, so I worked another 5 or 6 months after I officially retired.
And then you also wanted to mention your dates with the art department.
Yes, it was. I have recorded in my notes over the years that it was 1976 to 82, but then I did notice that in 85, 86, I also taught. So I guess I skipped a few years too. So, but those are the general, that's the general ballpark.
Okay. And then you wanted to mention the first preservation officer, his name.
Yes, the first preservation officer, his name was Bill Patch. What I did was I went down to Chicago and took a course. It was for the entire summer. This was back in the early 70s. And I was hoping to become the preservation librarian at that time. And it was really a wonderful class. And it talked about all aspects of managing a preservation department in a major library. The class was at the Newberry Library. And I stayed in a hotel for the whole summer, and the library gave me a leave, and I think it was paid leave to do this. I can't remember now, but it had to be paid leave. I can't imagine staying in a hotel all summer, you know, without getting some backup help at the time. But anyway, when I came back to the library, Mr. Trays, the director at that time, he mentioned to me that although he wanted to start a preservation department, that he had decided that he would pick the circulation head at that time who wanted to get out of that department. And so this was an older man. I think Bill was in his early 50s, and I was just in my 20s. And so I swallowed my disappointment and, wished the library well. At that time, preservation in most people's mind was putting things on microforms, microfilm and microform and microfiche. And there was a microform department, and so that was kind of integrated into the preservation of deteriorating books, to put them on microforms in the library. And I wouldn't have liked, if that was preservation to our library system, I wouldn't have wanted that job anyway. So, but anyway, that's how it started out. And then as the years went by, it wasn't too long before, the preservation committee continued. And then it wasn't too long after that that Jim Dast, with his help and the library support, the Library Conservation Lab got started, and it became just a wonderful, wonderful facility. And as time went by, then things got to the digitization of materials started, but also there was a lot of room for repairs, and there was a lot of instruction on in internships for people that wanted to learn to repair books. And so anyway, there was it really worked out really, really well, and I ultimately was very glad that I wasn't head of preservation.
Liz, thank you for that. I appreciate that extended answer there. One more thing you wanted to mention before we started asking questions yesterday, and that was your transition to working at Columbia in a public library to Memorial Library.
Right. One thing about, I was very, very happy to get out of the New York Public Library. It was sort of like what it must like be when you're inducted into the Army. Because when you think, when most people think of the New York Public Library, they think of the great library down on 42nd Street with the great big stone lions and all of the wonderful collections that that particular library has. And at that time, and I'm not sure right now how many libraries there are throughout New York City, but there were 83 branch libraries, and I was sent to the South Bronx. And so it really was not a pleasant experience because you were told where to go, and also I just wasn't really cut out for a big city public library with all the social problems that came with just managing people in a library. So but then coming to Memorial Library, I had in my mind of working in a big university library ever since I was thinking of librarianship, and I'd always worked in beautiful libraries. I always worked, I worked at Hamilton College Library in Clinton, New York, during the summers when I was going from high school through college during the summers. And then I worked at Columbia University for a year and a half as my first professional job. And they were just beautiful libraries with a long history of scholarship and wonderful, just terrific collections. And then coming to this great big box that of Memorial Library, it wasn't very inspiring at all. Just visually, so that was a little depressing. And I think I mentioned earlier on that I had a little office, with a single light bulb, in the North Stacks. I was, placed back there all by myself. But another thing, too, is that in the libraries I had always worked in, every single library ever since I was just started out, a work day was 7 hours plus lunch, and that made it an 8-hour day. So it was 9 to 5 or 8 to 4, depending on what library you were in. So actually coming to University of Wisconsin Memorial Library and having it an 8-hour day, not including lunch, it took a long time, in fact, several years before I could get used to the fact that I was working so many hours per week, more hours, I would be 5 more hours per week, and getting the same salary. So it just seemed really strange to me. And I've often wondered how statistics are compiled comparing library salaries because the work days are so different, and the aggregate work hours per year. So I was just wondering if they allow for that, when they compare salaries from one institution to another. But anyway, I think that's what influenced me to be a member of the 4-day work week, which was a committee that started many years ago. And I'm trying to remember when it was. I think it was, 73 to 74. I was very interested. I think the state had changed some of its rules about work weeks, and a lot more flexibility was allowed. I'm not sure about that, but in any case, the library was in favor of a 4-day work week if a committee would, you know, figure out if it was manageable. And people in technical services really especially liked the idea because, you know, if you worked 10 hours for 4 days, you've got your 40 hours in. And it wasn't like being in public service, you know, where you really had to have the desk, reference desk available or circulation available to people for long hours that you had to staff and make sure, you know, someone was present. So anyway, that motivated me to be, to start the, I'm trying to think if I was chair or not. No, I don't think I was chair of that. But anyway, that was in 1973 and 74.
Okay.
Speaking of committees, one committee that was kind of interesting that I was given by Mr. Trays was the parking committee. I didn't realize at the time, but I suspected it. No one at the time wanted to be head of the parking committee. And that's a committee where you set guidelines for who gets the best places on campus to park. You know, and there were applications, and it was a very contentious issue in the library. People would want to park. People that wanted to park close to the library, you know, they would, you know, write that they needed special, you know, they had special problems such as, you know, extra number of children, or they had, you know, special health problems, or this or that and the other thing. And so, when assignments were given to the library had only a certain number of parking spaces that it could have from the transportation office. The head of the parking committee always, you know, got to be the one to be blamed, you know. So anyway, that always, afterwards, I got to laugh about it because I saw that when other new members came to the library, they got to be head of the parking committee.
So it was sort of like an initiation?
Yes, it was initiation, and I really got to get to know the people in the library and you know, what their personalities were like, and et cetera, et cetera.
Since we're on the topic of committees, yesterday you talked about the exhibit committee. I wonder if you would talk a little bit about your time on that committee.
Yes, I was in charge of the reference department had when it was in room 120. It's now called 112 or vice versa, but it's a very very huge room that's on the Langdon Street side of the library. It used to have a little hallway to get into the reference department, and I started putting up on the bulletin board different little exhibits. And anyway, the library needed somebody to be in charge of the exhibits for the library. And the exhibits at that time were on the second floor. There were these two cases. One was outside the card catalog room, and one was outside the periodical room. And because I really enjoyed doing exhibits, I got to be in charge of that. And it wasn't really, it didn't start out as a committee. It was just, the library wanted somebody just to do exhibits there. And so I volunteered. And then as time went by, the library wanted also to have exhibits on the first floor as you come in to the library. And by at that time, the South Stacks had been built, and there was a new wing, and so, and a new entrance to the library, and so, Rare Books got involved with that, and another, at least people, staff from Rare Books, and I was asked to be, as a member of this new committee, and I continued until the time I retired to be on the exhibits committee. I didn't like being a part of an exhibits committee because I just don't think that it's like doing an artwork. It's very hard to do it by committee. But I did things best when I did them by myself with maybe someone to help, type up labels and things like that. But I don't know if it's because I have a controlling nature or what, but the better exhibits, the ones I had more fun with were ones that I did myself. But there weren't that many on the first floor. I was part of a committee.
Now, when you were talking about the exhibits committee yesterday, you mentioned some aspects that you enjoyed about it, like tapping into your artistic side and also the scholarly aspects of it. I wonder if you
want... Oh, yes. That's what I just loved about the exhibits committee because you had to have it visually attractive, but also it meant, going deep into the subject area and when you made labels, you also made handouts if people were interested in obtaining literature on the subject. You also got a chance to go to other libraries, such as the State Historical Society or Steenbach or to the Rare Books Department, even the Art Department for other kinds of things. And so I had a lot of fun, getting out of the library and just getting out of the reference department when I did that. It was a wonderful way to get something different to do.
Great, thank you. Liz, there were sort of two major topics we touched on yesterday. The first one was your creation of a practicum for library school students. So I wonder if you could... talk now about that.
Sure. In 1976, the first semester of that year, I guess that would be. I'm looking at an annual report, which was July 76 to June 77. So. The first semester would have been September 76. That was when we had our first library school student. and that started out because when I started out in the reference department, I had one day of training, and that was just kind of a tour of the reference department and what was there. I was expected at the end of the week to be on the reference desk on the week. This was at the weekend on a Saturday or Sunday with someone to observe, and then from then on, I was assigned a night and a weekend shift of 5 hours. We had weekend shifts of 8 to 1. Or 1 to 6 on Saturday and 1 to 6 on Sunday. And the reference staff at that time was working 3 out of 5 1 5-hour shifts. This was 3 out of 5 weeks we would have a 5-hour shift. And it was really, really scary starting in the reference department. And I think that Marge Christensen, my supervisor, because I had worked with the public in the New York Public Library when I was going to Columbia. I think she thought that I had a great, vast amount of experience because I think, like many people, she was thinking of the Lyons Library down on, 42nd Street, and that I must, that I really didn't need all that training. I don't know, what was on her mind. But at that time, there was a huge turnover of staff, and most of us who started were had just gotten out of library school, and I wasn't the only one that had started out this way. And at that time, Janine Toubaville had started a few months before me, and we also had some other people, and in particular, Priscilla Neal, who worked with Interlibrary Loan. She was in the same office. But anyway, we all had very, very little training, and so I thought it would be really great to have a practicum because I just felt, since there was a library school, that it would be nice if students could get some more experience. But also, I wasn't completely altruistic. I thought it would be nice to have some help on the weekends in the department so that you had somebody to work with and to take some of the pressure off, because of working 3 out of 5 weekends was really rough. So Janine and I went to talk to the director then of the library school to see what they thought of a practicum or some kind of arrangement with a reference course. And so it turns out that it was approved, to see how it would work out. And so that's how it started. And there was a little in the annual report that I have in front of me. I remember that the practicum student that was referred to as the first student was Cheryl Becker. And Cheryl Becker is still working in libraries. I think she's in a public library in or around Madison. I thought she was on campus, but I think she's in a public library. And I'll never forget, what a wonderful student she was. But in the report it said that the first student worked Sunday afternoons and one night per week in order to fulfill the library practicum. So, and it said that she worked as backup help during busy hours to obtain experience in public service. The following semester, there were two girls and one boy. We called them girls and boys. Back then, Marge Christensen called us her girls. I mean, things were a little different about, speaking of each other as men, young men and women. but anyway, that worked pretty well for a time, but we all felt that just at the time that they were getting some experience and that they were of really good use to us, they left. So what happened as time went by was that the practicum became part of it became 120 hours. I think it started out as a 40-hour experience, but then it went up to 120 with 40 hours of training. I hope I'm correct in saying that, but it seems to me that it was 120 hours they gave a semester, because the training was something that they had to undergo, and it was pretty intense, because they all met with me as a group, and they did assignments and things like that. But I would really have to I'm really surprised that, you know, my memory isn't, you know, that clear about it, but it, I might be confusing it with the independent study, but I do know that there was a lot of trading, and I still have the outlines of what was covered, so.
Liz, thank you for that. Were there other, I think you alluded or talked about this in that answer right there, but were there other benefits that you received or you feel you received from starting this project and watching it grow?
Oh, yes. I got to learn what the reference department is all about myself. I found that true also with teaching in the art department. Was, I mean, when you teach, you have to be sharp, and you have to really know what you're saying, and you have to be able to, you know, be quite a few steps ahead of people that you're teaching. So, I got to really, really know the collection, and also I got to work more closely with the existing staff. The other staff members would be involved. For instance, there would be a little section on government documents because the students would have to know where the documents were and how they were arranged on 2M in the South Stacks. And so they would have to learn about that. And they would have to know where different departments in the library were. So, you know, to be able to refer people to other areas of the library. So there would be a grand tour of the library and a talk by rare books and a talk by people in the mending department, and they would be shown where the theses were bound and where the APs were in the basement and why there was an AP system, which was an old system that the Memorial Library had started out with before incorporating the Library of Congress system. So there was a lot to cover, and so anyway, I got to be able to involve the entire library, you know, and it was really, really rewarding, because one thing about reference is you're answering questions all the time at the reference desk, and then as time went on, you know, you had email questions, and, you know, of course, there was written correspondence, and then you had your classes, but with practicum students, you actually got to know anywhere from 4 to 6 students very, very well each semester. And so it was really nice just feeling that I had some in-depth relationship with students. And even up to the time I retired, students would write me a note or send me a card, you know, telling me where they were, and you know, that was very gratifying too. That, you know, I was still remembered, you know, by a number of them.
Thank you. There's a couple of anecdotes.
Go ahead.
I'd like to get to, but I want to make sure we get the grant stuff on, too.
Of course.
So let's move to your work in the grant collection. So we'll start off by how that started.
Okay. The grant collection started in 1989, and there was a member of the community who was a grant writer and helped people find grants. His name was Boris Frank, and as far as I know, he's still somebody that, you know, people hire to help them with their nonprofit grant seeking purposes. Anyway, Boris Frank is from the Madison area, and he approached Gene Thompson, in charge of the reference department, in 1989, and said that UW Milwaukee had this wonderful grant collection, and he was wondering if Gene would be interested in checking out and seeing if we could have one. And so Gene went to UW Milwaukee and talked about and checked out the collection. And to make a long story short, there are collections around the country called cooperating collections that are part of the Foundation Center, which is located in New York City. And what happens is that they publish materials on grants, and they have all these satellite libraries, and they have requirements for these libraries, and if they meet the requirements, then they get these materials for, at that time it was a $600 membership fee, and you had a connection with the Foundation Center too, in the sense that not only did you get their published materials, but you got instruction on grant making and grant seeking. You got classes that you from them every year. You went to New York City for a 3-day workshop, and also you could call them anytime for assistance if you were in helping other people. And eventually they had, you know, web pages, training materials that were online and still are. It's just a wonderful thing. And so anyway, and you also had to give a certain number of classes per year yourself, you know, in your library as part of the requirement. So anyway, we got approved, and so anyway, we got the collection, and it came also with something called FC Search, which was their materials, their foundation materials on CD-ROM. And Jane Thompson felt that at one point that she was just too busy with her administrative duties to take part in this, keeping up the, you know, what all the things that you needed to do to keep up the collection and helping people, et cetera. So she asked if anybody was interested in, taking part in it. And I said that I would love to be head of the collection. And my ulterior motive was really, and not just that I wanted something of my own, but also I wanted desperately to get rid of the telephone directory collection. And being in charge of that, and also being in charge of the college catalogs, I just didn't want it anymore. And so I got rid of those responsibilities in exchange for the grant collection. And it was just one long table with one shelf on both sides, so that the collection was rather small, but there was a lot more to it than just that table, because there were two dedicated computers in the room behind the reference desk that were only for using grant searches, and so using the CD-ROMs. And eventually we got more and more computerized materials, so that in the table was moved closer to the that room. One thing that I really, really wanted desperately at the time I retired was for the whole collection to be in that room, and that eventually happened. Nikki Bush, who got the was in charge of the collection afterwards, she made sure that she got that done, and it's really, really a nice room now. It's got new furniture, and it's got places for cereals, and a lot more signage, and another thing about that room too was when I started having grant appointments that I would give, and so people would come in for grant appointments, and it was rather, I just thought it was really a bad idea for people to come in to that room and talk about their, either their individual financial needs or the problems that their nonprofits were having. And meanwhile, there were other people in that room either studying or using other computers for their research or whatever. So anyway, I just thought that was not a good idea, and I was really glad that it eventually got to be just a room for people to come to where they could, you know, have some kind of privacy.
Liz, I wonder if you could talk about the international aspect. We talked about that quite a bit yesterday. So the international aspect of your job and why you felt it was important.
Well, with a web presence, I ended up having 78 web pages, and I had lots and lots of seminars I was giving, and I was also going around the state giving talks, and I was also giving seminars with UW Continuing Education and doing all kinds of things like that. But one thing I noticed that I was getting more and more email from overseas, and I got to be really, really quite knowledgeable about not grants, in helping people that were from other countries that needed help. And so a lot of times they were so desperate that I really went out of my way oftentimes. Like in the United States, there were cooperating collections like ours in public libraries or in other university libraries. But there are other libraries strategically positioned in areas throughout the United States, and I would direct people to those areas to get more information. But internationally, there weren't that many places for people to go. But because I had access, quick access to all sorts of resources, et cetera, I could quickly download information from a database, or I could send them information about grant websites or grant directories that they could purchase that I could find out about that would apply to their countries. And so the word really spread. And also the grants, when you look on Google grants information, the grants information collection, or it was called the Grant Information Center then, would be one of the very first, it would be, if not the first thing that came up, it would be one of the first. So it wasn't just popularity of, you know, UW collection, but it was the internet that brought it up. And so people would email, and I really, really got so interested in international in helping people internationally. But I did have this nagging feeling about whether it was part of the Wisconsin idea or not, and there was this pressure from bibliographic instruction area of the department and of the library to do more teaching of classes like, for instance, in English, in anthropology, and, you know, other humanities areas. And so I wasn't doing as much non-grant teaching, you know, as other people, but I still felt that I was doing more teaching than anybody else in the department at the time. So but at the same time, I was kind of torn, you know, about this. It turned out after I left that all that those aspects, answering international questions, that dropped. It was no longer a service. You know, email questions were just referred to the Foundation Center, which was really a disservice because the foundation. I was close to people at the Foundation Center. I got to know them over the years, and all they did with questions was just say, "Well, we have this, this, and this." I mean, it was just a stock answer. And I just got so much feedback, you know, from people. And there, a lot of the people that needed help were people that were actually at the university who needed more help with. The grants, you know, to keep studying or to, you know, do research. So it wasn't just that, you know, it wasn't that I was ignoring the university, you know, population or anything like that.
Liz, how did you learn how to teach, teaching people how to find out about grants?
The Foundation Center has a wonderful program. You're at that time were required to go to New York City. Once every 2 years, and they were trying to encourage you to go every year in October. They would have a 3-day workshop, and I didn't know anything when I started out with the grant collection, and I was just blown away by all of the aspects of grants and. You know, the grant world, and I didn't really understand what a nonprofit was. I didn't understand how to really effectively help someone until I took workshops from them and actually, you know, met grant makers, and I got to learn the language of grants, and I got to learn, you know, what a foundation is, and you know, what a nonprofit needs to do in order to be effective, you know, in terms of, you know, applying for a grant. A lot of people that are looking for grants are not really prepared. I mean, they're not, whether it's a nonprofit or a person, they don't understand what you need to have in place before you're even ready to get a grant. And, so anyway, that was part of the teaching too, is to, you know, help nonprofits, you know, get their nonprofits stronger.
Liz, were there people in the library or library system that also helped with teaching or how to teach?
Grants?
Just in general. I think last time you mentioned a woman named Abby Loomis.
Oh, yes. Abby Loomis. We had a terrific woman. I mean, she just... I couldn't praise her highly enough. We had a bibliographic instruction department. The woman's name was Abby Loomis, and what she did is she coordinated all the teaching programs on campus that involved the libraries, she also promoted a lot of library instruction in the library on teaching, you know, how to teach classes, and made up all kinds of, you know, handouts, and she also coordinated schedules, you know, with the instructors on campus, and she just was wonderful, and she would get guest lecturers in on how to teach or how students learn, you know, visually or there are other people that learn better by reading, you know, and other people are better if they listened to something, you know, so anyway, it was really interesting all the stuff that she did that really supported the teaching mission of the library.
Liz, maybe one more thing about the grants collection, and that's, you've alluded to it and talked about it a couple of times, but I'll ask the question directly, the rise of technology as you continued in the role, how technology evolved and assisted.
Yes. Well, we started out with computers. Well, first of all, we had, everything was in paper, and then we would have microfilm and microfiche, which were those little plastic cards. And like, for instance, with the telephone collection, and even the college catalog collection, that turned out that we would get microfiche, and rather than the paper copies of items. And then you would get CD-ROMs, or CDs, and all of those things still had to be acquired and cataloged, and you had that. You're getting less and less paper products, and then we started getting and then also you get CDs for large numbers of indexes, and so they were disappearing from the shelf. But then all of a sudden we got the computer catalog, and that was called NLS at the time, and no web pages or anything. It wasn't no pictures. It was just type, and so there was NLS, and then you had lots and lots of instruction. There became the library technology. There became a library technology instruction crew, and then you'd have technical support. But anyway, you had this catalog that was called NLS, and then you had this new service called BRS, and two librarians got training in being able to search dissertation abstracts and some other major databases in exchange for a fee. And so there was that, and then all of a sudden we got something called we got computers that could do what was called word processing, and I was one of the last people to get involved with learning Microsoft Word, or what then started out as WordPerfect in our library, until I realized how wonderful it was to be able to type out labels for the exhibits and be able to correct mistakes, just by deleting something or backing up a space. I just found out it'd be just a wonderful thing, in the library. But then when the web came, that entirely transformed absolutely everything. It also made life much easier, especially in teaching, because I could make materials, and they could put them on the library website, and so that people could go home, and then they could get into the handout, and they could use the links, to various things that I could point out to online as examples. I mean, they could go back into the handout. That was in more recent times.
Liz,
anyway, it was really fun.
Liz, there is one more thing I want to ask about the grants collection, and that's what student assistants, if any, did you have during the course of your time leading that collection?
With the grants?
Yeah.
I tried having a tasked him with the grant collection, but it didn't really, I felt really nervous about student assistance with, you know, handling grant appointments without Mike being there. And I felt that it was so training intensive that with the practicum program and all the other stuff I was doing, it really didn't work out that well. So I only had a couple of grant internships. But there was a librarian named Lori Wormter in the department who got very interested in the collection and became very helpful in assisting in numerous ways. She didn't like teaching, but she would help in other ways. She actually got inspired to start her own nonprofit, and she formed her own nonprofit, and it actually gives a grant in labor history. And so, because she started her own nonprofit, she also, got interested in helping people when I wasn't around, and I felt very comfortable with her helping with the collection. Actually, the grant collection was part of the reference department, so everybody helped with the grant collection. It's just that I was in charge of it, so I did a lot more, with it, in terms of, the web pages and talks and appointments and things like that.
Liz, there's a couple of anecdotes that you mentioned yesterday before the recorder snafu. I want to make sure we get those on the record. The first was, you talked about how Marge Christensen would let you make mistakes, and your anecdote about that was the telephone book collection.
Oh, right.
You want to retell that anecdote?
Oh, yeah, Marge Christensen was... I remember when I was in charge of the telephone collection, I thought it was just a little rinky-dink collection that I just, I just wasn't interested in it, and I didn't understand why you'd really have a telephone book collection when you could just call up directory assistants, et cetera, et cetera. And I didn't really think it was being used much, and I noticed a lot of the books were old, and so anyway, I thought, okay, I'm in charge of this collection, so... I never really asked how much money was available to purchase directories, et cetera, but I found this telephone collection order catalog. So I ordered 300 telephone books, and it was like opening Pandora's box. I mean, they started arriving, and there was no really good system to check them in or to, show what was available. And so I had to kind of, figure that out. And then it never occurred to me, for instance, that when you got a telephone book from Tokyo, that it would be 3 to 6 volumes. I remember how huge it was. And, it took up a lot of space, and it was in Japanese. And, then there would be problems, like, for instance, Dublin. Like, Ireland was having a really, it was really bad time, politically and socially, with a lot of upheavals. And so we got the telephone book. I think it was up to M. And that was it. I mean, it just stopped. And there's some other interesting things, but that language thing was really funny, too, because... I mean, in retrospect, I'm sure it wasn't funny to Marge, but, they would be in different languages, and, who could read them and who would use them, and another thing was we got one from Egypt, and in the phone book, you could only be listed if you were an Egyptian citizen. So even if you had a telephone, suppose you were, a student or a faculty member and you went to Egypt and you, you know, had a phone line, you wouldn't be in the phone book because you weren't an Egyptian citizen. So, I mean, there were just all sorts of interesting things about these phone books that I just didn't know about. And I don't know. Well, anyway, Marge was just very laissez-faire, as were most of my supervisors throughout the years. And she just rolled her eyes when they came in and just, you know, it's like, whatever, you know. So, but I just learned immediately, you know, after, you know, a year or two, that there was a reason why it was a small collection and why you just had Paris, London, you know, a few other, you know, a few other telephone books that people might look in, and there's a reason why you didn't have, you know, every country in the world. So.
Liz, the other, I think there's at least two more. Another one was you talked about the 70s and the change in the work environment, specifically dress code.
Yeah, when I first started, well, one thing about reference is that you've always wanted to look presentable, and even today, I mean, you want to look, you know, professional and presentable, but back then, it was very rigid. There was a man named Mr. Kaplan, and he would have a bell announcing breaks for everybody. This is what I was told, and you had 20 minutes, and then there'd be a bell when the break was over. And when Mr. Trace came in, which is a few months before I arrived, or a few months after, one or the other. But anyway, it was okay to wear, it immediately changed. It was okay to wear pants. If you were a woman, you could wear pants as long as it was a pants suit. And, you know, as long as, I'm not matching, you know, a blouse that looked nice with pants. It had to be a suit. So we went around, many of us breathed a sigh of relief, and we, you know, were wearing pants suits at the time. And then I was one of the first people to start wearing jeans, because I remember one day I was really nervous, because I had Thursday afternoon off because I was working Thursday night at the reference desk. So in the morning I thought, oh gee, I'll just wear jeans, because I was going to go straight to horseback riding, and I was going to be picked up right outside the library. So I wore jeans that morning. I made sure that they were nice. They weren't dirty. They were clean, and you know, and I wore, you know, I was fairly presentable. And I remember waiting, you know, in my jeans outside the library on the Langdon Street entrance, and Mr. Trace came up the library steps and passed me, and all he said was, "Hi, Liz, how are you doing?" And I said, "Fine." And he never blinked an eye. So I thought, well, I guess it's okay. So, but shortly after that, you know, more and more people, you know, from time to time were wearing jeans and or wearing pants without it being a pants suit. And I'm talking about women. And up to this day, you know, not that many people in public service wore jeans. And so, but it was just, you know, those were the Thursdays when I was going horseback riding, and I just didn't want to go home and change.
Liz, one last question from last time, and I asked a question about changes in technology as a reference librarian, and that led you to talk about that, but also talk about an anecdote about one of your last email exchanges with a student.
Yes, I was having a difficult time. Well, first of all, I noticed that more people were Googling for information, and on the desk we were starting, you know, people were were talking about, should we have a blog? And one thing that was starting up was something called chat. So when you were on the breakfast desk, you had people, you had the phone, you had chat, you had email. And we would get lots and lots of email questions, which was fine, except that one day I got a question about a mammal, and someone wanted a scientific description of the mammal and a picture, and I know that I could probably have gone to a Xerox room and like done an image and sent the image to the person, et cetera, et cetera. But we had this wonderful series of books, and I can't remember the title, but they were authoritative text on mammals, and you know, with the scientific, you know, origins and names, et cetera. So this reference interview with this person went back and forth for about 10 minutes. Like, did you want the picture in color? How much information do you need? All kinds of things. And well, anyway, then I said to the person, did the person need it right away? And she said, the person said, yes. And I said, well, what library are you near? You know, or couldn't you pick up the information? And it turns out after this long back and forth that the person was sitting right in front of me, two tables away from the reference desk. And I just thought, technology was just going too far, you know. So I noticed as, you know, the days and weeks went by that students were, you know, multitasking, and, you know, they would, and other people in the reference desk would notice too that, you know, people were emailing or chatting right from being inside the room or inside the library. And it just wasn't as much fun anymore. I noticed too that even the help we were getting people from other parts of the library that were working at the reference desk because of the volume, and particularly from interlibrary loan. And despite all the training, et cetera, everybody was Googling answers, and I just felt you didn't need to be knowledgeable anymore about the collection or about databases. You just needed to, you were just providing, websites, or you're providing, you're also helping people with in learning database protocols rather than really learning with them about their topic, or doing in-depth research. So it just wasn't, I was just sitting at a computer most of the time, even on the reference desk, and I just felt I just didn't want to sit at a computer all day long anymore, except of course when I was teaching, et cetera. But still, you're still showing people how to do things with computers, and I was just tired of that.
Well, Liz, I think that covers everything, and you know, nicely you. We added a bit more here. We're at almost an hour and 4 minutes now, and we were at 50-something when the recorder knocked over. So we sort of did the final, questions in the interview that was recorded yesterday. So,
oh, good.
Unless there's something on your mind that you don't think you've talked about, I think we can wrap it up.
Okay. I do have I do want to mention that the Memorial Library online community news of August 2006, that has a write-up that I did about the grant collection and my experiences. If anyone wants to, you know, check that or in the future. And I do have like another minute to mention some emails that came, and one of them that I had forgotten about was that I would like to mention was I did get an email once from Santa Lucia, I think that's how you pronounce it, requesting funding for a zoo. And they thought, it, like many people, erroneously, that we were a grant maker. And the request said that if I didn't have funds to send to their organization, then would I send animals with great expediency? And I just always thought that was really funny.
Mm, that's great.
Yeah, and then I got another email saying, we are young ladies of medium qualification in Nepal, and we have some practical training in briquette making and need $5,000 to help the community provide better indoor cooking stoves. Details are provided. We've tried so hard and are about to lose our enthusiasm. I just love letters like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an awful lot of fun replying to those. I think that's why I liked grants so much, especially the international requests.
Well, Liz, I'm going to officially stop this recording, and then we might chat for a minute or two after that. So,
okay, I'm ready to stop.
Yeah, this concludes the oral history with Liz Breed. Liz, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much.